It is Tuesday night, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez. We'll be here till 1 a.m. when Nick D takes over. A lot to talk about tonight, and I want to remind you, we would love to hear from you. There's a lot of stuff that people are reacting to in the news today, and one of the biggest stories, of course, is this college cheating scandal. There's a ringleader who has pled guilty to $25 million in nationwide college admissions, the scam, helping people get their kids into elite schools, whether it was by having some of the administrators of the SATs and ACTs take the exams for them, creating spots for them on teams for sports that they did not play, lesser known sports that aren't as high profile as football or basketball. They would get them onto volleyball teams, on the water polo team, the rowing team, and maybe that student would just be on the rowing machine for the whole season. They would Photoshop photos of the kids onto athletes in order to pretend that they had some sports history. And on the line with us is attorney Don Jackson, who specializes in some of the sports law, in particular collegiate level lawsuits, and representing students and athletic directors, really quite an incredible history of experience. Don, how are you doing tonight?
Just fine. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And I'm so glad that someone referred you to us, because I thought this is somebody who can really shed some light on this. First of all, you must have some idea of how deep and widespread this was before all of us even found out about it today, didn't you?
Yes. I mean, frankly, I'm not that surprised I'm not that surprised with the indictments. There was a case that occurred that was actually ongoing right now involving the former head basketball coach at the University of Pennsylvania, and one of his former assistants is on the staff at Auburn University, and they were alleged to have done the exact same thing. Ironically, that case, involving those two gentlemen, a lot of that evidence came out over the course of the last week, so I'm not too surprised by this at all. It's just been a fairly ongoing type of conspiracy.
And how does this kind of, for folks who are just catching up, from your understanding and the information that was released today, you know, tell people a little bit about how this process works for rich parents who, by the way, isn't it infuriating to you, Don, that their kids could pretty much do anything in life that these parents want them to do, and some of these folks are spending up to $6 million to get their kids into the school they want? It's got to be infuriating for you and a lot of your colleagues and people that you know that are you know, going through the system.
Certainly. Essentially, what they were doing is they were bribing coaches to essentially characterize their children as recruitable athletes. They had no intention whatsoever of these young people participating in collegiate athletes. They were essentially characterizing them as collegiate athletes in order to take advantage of what they considered to be sort of preferential admissions policies for student athletes. I'm involved in cases on a fairly routine basis involving student athletes whose ACT or SAT standardized test scores are challenged based on alleged academic fraud. And the thing that's really troubling about this is the fact that the NCAA likely did not even question the standardized test scores for these young people, and have they been legitimate student athletes in revenue sports, basketball or football, the test scores likely would have been red flagged and challenged, but apparently they were not challenged in this situation, and that's even more troubling.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that, you know, people who work really hard, who are, you know, do everything they can and do everything right, look at this and just think, you know, what chance do we have? I mean, for Stanford, the applications that they get is over 45,000, and they will only take 2,000 students. And now you've got some of those spots going to parents who want their kids to, you know, to be amongst other elites. It's maddening, isn't it?
Well, and you know, and the interesting thing about it is that this has occurred for years, but it's occurred in a different way where you have wealthy people, sometimes boosters of athletic departments, sometimes alumni from schools that make contributions to athletic foundations, they make contributions to various departments within schools, and their kids wind up having a legitimate spot as a walk-on in a college program. I guess I'm more comfortable with that because at least in that situation, you've got young people that actually have a desire to participate in intercollegiate athletics. In this situation, they essentially backdoored their way into admissions into elite universities and essentially potentially took opportunities away from students that had the qualifications and a legitimate desire to participate in intercollegiate sports. That's highly troubling.
I'm going to take a break here. I know that David Jennings has a question from the newsroom. But actually, David, we can take it right now. David, David.
Don, how are you?
Just fine, David. How are you?
I'm good. A couple of things. One, if the parents are as wealthy as we see them to be, why didn't they just endow a chair, pay for a building, put their name on it, their kid goes to the school, it's no problem. That's one. And the second thing is, are any of the kids facing legal jeopardy? Because I have a funny feeling some of these kids knew exactly what mommy and or daddy were doing and knew it was the wrong thing to do. I noticed none of the kids were indicted. So those are the two things I'm curious about.
First of all, yes, and I'm not saying that I'm in agreement with the other scenario, but what you said initially was absolutely the case. I mean, there are all sorts of historical situations where you've got young people that are admitted in the universities, elite universities around the country, sometimes even as athletes, when they don't have the objective qualifications to be admitted. After a family member or a friend of the family makes a contribution to a university, to an athletic department, to an athletic foundation, that happens. And frankly, had that occurred in this situation, it might have saved these families potential jail sentences, potential jail time. The next thing, as it relates to the young people, at least at the moment, none of the students were charged. I suspect that quite a number, if not all of them, had some degree of knowledge as far as their parents' actions are concerned. But I think because of the fact that the money came from the parents, the primary focus was going to be on the parents and actually provided essentially the bribes to get them into these universities. In these types of situations, it's fairly unlikely, even in collegiate sports situations, the NCAA FBI case that's ongoing right now, where student athletes receive money from illicit sources. It's fairly unusual for legal action to be initiated against the students. So I doubt that will occur in this situation.
We are talking to Don Jackson. He's an attorney who has a long history of working with students, with athletic directors, with all kinds of folks at the collegiate level when it comes to being in a situation that a fraud has been committed. And what other cases have you worked on, Don? I know we're talking about this in particular. It sounds like you've had a lot of experience.
Over almost a three-decade involvement in sports, I've represented universities. I've represented literally at this point hundreds of student athletes and academic reviews and all sorts of enforcement and compliance-related matters. I've represented coaches on the collegiate level in front of the NCAA Infractions Committee, Infractions Appeals Committee. And on the professional side, I've represented numerous professional athletes and coaches as well. It's interesting. One of the cases and also quite a number of prospective student athletes in challenges to their standardized test scores. I was involved in a case several years ago involving a player who's now in the NBA. He was a player at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, at that time, where his ACT score was challenged by the NCAA and the testing service. And in that particular situation, his test score was red flagged, despite the fact that he had only taken the exam one time. I mean, I can understand scenarios where you've got a young person that takes the exam three times. The first time he makes a 12, the next time he makes a 12, and the third time he makes a 29 or a 30. In this situation, the young man only took the exam one time, made a qualifying score, and his test score was still challenged. And that, having been involved in a case like that and seeing this occur, it's highly troubling because of the fact that quite often these cases, the academic reviews involving student-athletes, I've always believed to have been somewhat racially selective, because they principally focus on African-American and international student-athletes. Highly troubling to see this case with legitimate academic fraud, with a different demographic, and the NCAA apparently did not intervene to question any of this until now.
In your experience, before we go, I just wanted to ask you, you mentioned facing possible jail time. Do you think that that's possible in these cases? Obviously, the ringleader has already pled guilty, and I'm wondering if that's an exchange for information. But in your experience, do you think that it's possible that any of these folks will go to prison?
I think it's more of a likelihood for Singer, the ringleader. I think there's also a potential as well. There's a gentleman that was director of advisement, of college advisement at a prep school from down in Florida. I think there's a very realistic possibility there as well. But as it relates to these parents, because of the fact that none of them, have prior criminal histories, because of the fact that these charges were in federal courts, ultimately, even if they work out, please, federal sentencing guidelines will be what will govern the sentences. There's a fairly reasonable likelihood that if they are sentenced to any jail time at all, it'll be at the lower end of the sentencing range. Again, the absence of prior criminal histories will probably be to their benefit and may prevent them from serving more than just maybe a few months. If any time at all.
I want to thank you so much, Don, for sharing your insight and your expertise. We've been talking to Don Jackson. You can go to thesportsgroup.org to find out more about the work he does. If you ever need his services, he might be someone that you need in the future. You never know. Don, we'd love to talk to you again sometime and learn more about your career and the work that you do.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Have a good evening. More after this on 720 WGN. What do you guys think? How do you feel about this scandal? Because I know a lot of people are frustrated. I know I am. What are you thinking tonight? 312-981-7200. Call or text us right now. More in a moment. Earlier this morning, it was reported that over 30 wealthy parents have been charged with fraud following an investigation into a massive college admissions scam. And Dave has some thoughts on this. And I agree with Dave, but I don't think I realized it was at this scale. Hey, Dave, what do you want to say?
Hey, you know, this is a joke, and I'll tell you why. This has been going on forever. And if they really wanted to go after the people that are violating college admissions,
yes,
they would be doing it to the people who are the chief violators, the sons and daughters of industry leaders, our corporate leaders, CEOs, executives,
yep,
sons and daughters of, you know, doctors and lawyers. This goes on all the time. I went to school with people who were just basically C students and somehow got into Ivy League schools or got into prestigious schools, or they had they were taken care of. Why they decide to do this now with, you know, I don't know all these 30 people whom they're charging with. It seems that most of them are in the media or they're Hollywood celebrities, and they, you know, this is a joke.
Oh, just two of them are, but this is all the 30 parents are not necessarily famous. I think part of what some of the level of egregiousness that this reaches is that some of the parents were instructed to teach their kids to act stupid for psychologists so they would be defined as having a learning disability and be given more time to take the SAT and ACTs. And they created a charity organization that was a sham that was put up to say, like, we're helping underserved children. I think that their hubris got away from them. It might have been going on forever. And I think part of that, as you mentioned, no one ever did anything about it. And so they just kept doing it until it grew to this point where this guy, just one guy who was facilitating it, made $25 million. And I'm guessing that's just some of it. I bet you it's not even all of it, Dave. I've got to run because I want to make sure we get the dance call. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. And I think you're right. It's been going on forever. We got to get these guys. All right, hold on one second. Let me take Dan's call before we go to the break. Hey, Dan, what do you want to say?
Oh, hi, Patty. Just want real quickly, if they're found guilty, we have to fine these individuals substantially. See, the problem with our justice system right now is they're not hitting people where it hurts. Fine them. If they fine them, I work in the banking sector, and we were fined substantially over the last 10 years collectively. Billions of dollars. And that's what we have to do with our justice system. With people with means, you have to find them.
Yep.
Thanks so much for taking my call, Patty.
I appreciate that. Great points, you guys. I love hearing from you. 312-981-7200. We're going to take a break and then the news on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, and we want to tell you about a great new, exciting, really kind of membership, I guess, is the best way to put it. We have our friends from, I'm sorry, I was like trying to, you guys brought me so much food from Smoke Daddy. We have Mallory and Sammy in studio, and I want to find out more. Mallory, you brought in some of the most amazing food, and I want to thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. Tell me about Smoke Daddy before we talk about the Lakeview social.
Sure. So Smoke Daddy is kind of a Chicago institution. It's been around in Wicker Park for over 20 years. We have live music 7 nights a week, and recently, in the past year, we opened our Wrigleyville location, which is where the Lakeview East tie-in comes in, and it's fantastic. It's right across the street from Wrigley Field and the whole Gallagher Way campus. Still live music 7 nights a week. We have a bottomless brunch. We have, smoked meats in-house. It's a fantastic restaurant, and it was really cool to be able to expand the institution of Wicker Park out into all of the development in Wrigleyville.
Yeah, no kidding. There's a couple things going on over there.
Building a little bit.
A little bit of growth.
A couple cranes up in the air.
And you brought some ribs, you brought some pulled pork and cornbread, and you've made us all very happy. I feel like there's been back-to-back great food coming into the station tonight. And I always feel guilty with our listeners because, you know, they're listening and we're talking about this great food, but it's partly to highlight what's going on in the neighborhoods and tell you about places maybe you haven't been to. One of our friends of the show, Tom Holland, plays at Smoke Daddy, but I believe he plays on the one on Division, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. He's a legend.
He loves talking about Smoke Daddy, and I've got to get out to see him sometime. We're here tonight to talk about not just Smoke Daddy, but the Lakeview Social Club, right?
Yes.
And so, Sammy, you're with the Lakeview Chamber of Commerce.
Correct. The Lakeview East Chamber. The Lakeview Supper Club has been an idea in the works for, honestly, the past couple of years, and we finally brought it to come to life. And essentially what it is it's a membership program, not just for the residents of Lakeview and Lakeview East, but essentially it's for Chicago residents as a whole. So what we do is we are trying to showcase the restaurants in Lakeview. We have a diverse amount of restaurants. We have Smoke Daddy, any barbecue joints, Old Crow, Wrigleyville. We also have, Mia Francesca, Angelina Ristorante, a lot of different places in Lakeview, including some Michelin star restaurants.
Nice.
So we wanted to showcase that to people in the area. So we came up with the Supper Club. Essentially what that is a membership program. It's just $10 a year to join. So really easy access to 3 events a month in different Lakeview restaurants.
It's just a great idea. You know, I was thinking about how disconnected we all tend to be. I mean, and there are wonderful sort of experiences like this. And what a great way to drive to sort of attract people to the Lakeview area and to restaurants, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. that maybe you haven't had the chance to experience before. But also with folks who are getting the same sort of updates you are, like, hey, this is what we have in mind. This is the great food we're all going to kind of talk about and enjoy in this neighborhood.
Yeah, and I think the best part of it is that exclusivity and that these are events that you're not going to get just by simply going to these places. So, for example, this upcoming Thursday, we have a chef's table at PR Italian Bistro. The chef is making a dinner for 12 people. That's seafood and wine. And then, for example, the Smoke Daddy event is a private dinner of shared barbecue. So, like you said, it brings people together, really gives that face-to-face interaction, meeting new people maybe, even in the neighborhood, but also learning about the restaurants. So, obviously, as the Chamber of Commerce, we're the biggest advocates of the businesses in the area. So, just bringing them to light, but also bringing people together to have a good time.
For anyone who's interested, the website is lakeviewsupperclub.com. Again, we're talking to our friends Sammy and Marley, who have come in to talk about this incredible opportunity to, because Lakeview is such a rich and diverse community mm-hmm. that has, a reputation maybe of just being about Wrigley, right? And yes. We get that, and that's got a lot of history to it, and people love it. There's also such great architecture. There's such great restaurants and such a wide range of what people can experience there. As you mentioned, music, there's theater in the neighborhood. You know, so when folks come in and you said they can learn about the restaurant, is there an opportunity to, like, talk to the chef? Are there nights where you feature perhaps a sommelier and things like that?
Yeah, definitely. So the chef's table is just one example of being hands-on with the chef and really being able to talk to them. We'll have more events down the line that you'll really be able to talk to the business owners. Even the other chamber events we do a lot of networking events with, B2B, other businesses in the area, where residents feel really connected to the restaurants and businesses in the area. I mean, Lakeview itself is, like you said, Wrigleyville, but also historic Boys Town in Broadway. So the small business owners there are really, really connected to the community.
Now, and I like that there's that connection, too. But mm-hmm. there's nothing like sitting around a table of food and conversation to make people feel a little bit, like we're not all in this alone. You know what I mean? Find new ways to meet people. And the website is the Lakeview. It's lakeviewsupperclub.com. And for $10, like you mentioned, people will get emails. It's not like you're being bombarded, but it's mm-hmm. updates on what the opportunities are, maybe some discounts, things that aren't available to everybody else.
Correct. Right. So once you sign up for an event, the events are released three at a time and you get a password. So there's kind of that exclusivity factor.
You got code. You got the code word. What's the pass?
Yeah. Exactly. So just signing in. And all the events are different price points depending on what they offer. So really honing in different types of experiences, whether it's live music, being one-on-one with the chef, or even, we're doing a tequila tasting in a couple of months as well.
That's something that is another, like I mentioned before, experiences, right? Mm-hmm. We have like these whiskey tastings. And by the way, gin is making a comeback. Tequila, people are enjoying those sorts of environments. And it's one of those things where you have maybe outside of your sort of comfort zone to learn something different, but also, it's also a nice way to sort of take a chance and go, you know what, I'm going to go hang out with these folks who have a similar interest, which is mm-hmm. enjoying good food and hanging out in Lakeview.
Yeah, we've had a couple events so far. We just launched a month ago, but for example, our last event was at Sheffield's Beer and Wine Garden in Wrigley, and people were sitting next to people that they've never met before that are residents in the neighborhood. And, they were sharing numbers and making plans to meet up. So I think that's something that's really missing in the world today. And I'm excited that we're able to bring people together.
And Mallory, you guys probably have folks that tag you guys whenever they're taking photos of their big plates of, ribs and things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one thing that really attracted us to this event in particular is, Four Star Restaurant Group is really focused on being a big part of the neighborhoods that they're in.
Right.
And like you pointed out yourself, a lot of times the focus in Lakeview is Wrigley, but it's such a great neighborhood and it's such an old established Chicago neighborhood. And we felt this was a great opportunity to bring the neighbors into the venue and make it their own and make them feel really comfortable and welcome from all over Lakeview, off season, not related to a Cubs game,
exactly,
but just related to being, a part of this neighborhood.
And we're going to take a break here, and I want to come back and talk a little bit about that. Not just, you know, because it's obviously a great way to meet your neighbors. Another way for people from outside of the neighborhood, maybe from the suburbs, to have sort of a, you know, in town, not coming downtown to the Magnificent Mile, but go to a real Chicago neighborhood, have some great food and meet great people and enjoy a wonderful evening of music and conversation. We are talking to our friends from the Lakeview Supper Club. You can go to lakeviewsupperclub.com for more information. We're hanging out with Mallory McSweeney from Smoke Daddy in Lakeview and Sammy Saliba. Am I saying your name correctly? Mm-hmm. I always want to make sure I ask. From the Lakeview East Chamber of Commerce. More conversation when we come back on 720 WGN. We are talking to our friends from the Lakeview Supper Club and some good music and hanging out here talking about the wonderful events and the access that you have to information that maybe, you know, it's not to keep people out. It's just to keep you updated, right? It's in order to let you know, like, what great food there is, what great music's coming up. You mentioned the chef's table. We're talking to Sammy Saliba. She's a communications manager for the Lakeview East Chamber of Commerce. And we have Mallory McSweeney from Smoke Daddy. I don't want to leave your title out. What's your title over at the Smoke Daddy?
Senior Sales and Business Development for Four Star Restaurant Group.
Well, that's like the whole kit and caboodle. Wow. Yeah. Where are you from originally?
Beverly.
Oh, from the South Side.
Yes.
Okay. Would you still live in the neighborhood? Or?
I live in Old Town now.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Nice. The Zanies?
Oh, yeah.
That's a good comedy club.
Love Zanies.
It's one of the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a fun neighborhood, too. It's amazing how much the neighborhoods have changed. I don't know how much you're familiar with how Lakeview was, you know. And it's funny because it starts to spread, right? It moves up Irving Park Road. And you've got, you know, whether people are coming in with condos and reinvigorating the community with different services and things like that. That's what makes this so much fun to join the Lakeview Supper Club, because you can find out as well what's going on in the neighborhood. And where are you from originally?
I'm from Cleveland, Ohio.
From Cleveland. Excellent. What brought you to Chicago?
I went to undergrad here. I went to Loyola. I studied ad PR, and then, you know, there's really no ad PR opportunities in Cleveland, Ohio. So here I am.
Why not? Just it's dried up?
It's cool now once I leave.
But, oh, no.
Back then, not so much. Yeah.
By the way, Tom is a Rambler, I believe. From every time we mention
Rambler. Nice. Yeah, go Ramblers. Honestly, we weren't that into them when I was there, but now they're cool. So.
What do you mean you weren't that into them?
They weren't good.
Oh, yeah. All right then. No, they were terrible? You're supposed to love your team anyway.
Mean, no, they were terrible. I'm just saying, you know, I love the Ramblers no matter what. So I'm going to throw that out there. No judgment, no disrespect.
Yeah, it's all right.
We're on the same page. Cool.
You know, the Iowa were not very good either when I was at U of I, but we went to every game. It was like the Lakeview Supper Club. You go to socialize.
Exactly.
See, you have a you know, sort of a common interest. You all get together and hang out.
I love to socialize, though.
I gotta have people to talk. Well, that it keeps your brain fresh, too.
Yeah.
I know that sounds silly, but having conversations with new people and new perspectives, you might not like them all, but you can go, that's something different.
Yeah, I think people are getting a little stagnant these days with how easy social media is. And, you know, all the different ways to communicate, we forget how important it is to actually talk to people. So
it's a little bit
exciting.
Yeah. It's very exciting.
It's so easy to stay in, but it's so much more fun to go out.
Yeah, no kidding. And that's, I mean, although you do get to a point where, you know, at a certain age where you go, I'm just going to Netflix tonight.
Yeah.
I'm just going to, do you have binge watch anything?
Everything.
Everything?
Same.
Do you have any favorites recently?
I just finished Catastrophe.
Oh, really? On Amazon.
So good. Yeah, exactly. Right. And Dairy Girls on
Netflix. I love Dairy. Have you seen Dairy Girls?
No, but I've been told to watch it.
It's
unbelievable.
Really good. And the timing's interesting, too, because of the possibility of Brexit, you know, creating this new wall between Northern and Southern
Absolutely.
Ireland.
Absolutely. I mean, it'll just be a nightmare if this all goes through.
It will. It will. Yeah. What are your favorite bingeable shows?
I'm excited for Queer Eye to come on Friday. I really enjoy that show. I watched each season in a day. I just finished Good Girls. I don't remember if it's Netflix or Hulu, but the second season of that's coming out, so I'm excited.
And that's, by the way, that's another theme you could do with the Lakeview Supper Club, is what did you binge and watch?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Maybe do some icebreaker questions, put people on the spot a little.
Yeah, I binge a lot of stuff. My mom just got through all six seasons of The Good Wife. I've been telling her for years how great it was, and then she started watching it. Now she like took her 2 weeks to watch all. It's a lot of watching TV.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I love it. I'm a big fan of The Good Wife. I'm just saying.
I'll put it on my list.
Yeah, put it on your list. Just watch a few episodes. If you're not in, I get it. I'm not going to be hurt. Do you ever get annoyed when people are like that? Oh my God, I can't believe you didn't like it. That's the weirdest thing to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. There's no reason to get that hostile about something that you love.
That's how I feel about personally. Friends sometimes, though.
What? You don't know
why? People don't like Friends. I get upset. Common loved shows, I'll get upset, but.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you have any, Mallory?
The West Wing. If somebody won't watch The West Wing, I get so upset.
So are these deal breakers? Like if you're, you know, having a conversation with like maybe a romantic interest, you're like, oh, if you don't like The West Wing, we're done.
Yeah, I just throw in like a Bartlett for President joke, and if they don't get it, I'm out.
Do you write what's next on a napkin if they don't get it? See, you didn't think I was going to do that, did you?
You're good. You're very good. I like you.
That's a deep cut. That's all right. How about you, other? So your deal breaker is Friends? How about that? You Friends or Seinfeld or both?
I have never seen an episode of Seinfeld. I'm
interesting.
Sorry.
No, but don't be sorry. It's okay.
I do love Friends. I really like everything, to be honest. So if I watch Seinfeld, I'll probably enjoy it.
Have you seen the Friends the musical? There's a stage version of this in Chicago right now.
But I want to. They're doing a Britney Spears musical. I just found out today, so I definitely want to see that. But
I've heard it's very good. Now I want to find out before we forget why we're here. We're talking about the Lakeview Supper Club. We have Mallory McSweeney, who is the director. There's like a big title that you had.
it's senior sales and business development.
Oh, so just, that's the biggest.
You know, helping build sales all around.
And what other restaurants do you have besides Smoke Daddy?
So we have Remington's here in the Loop, and then the Windsor, Ella Ellie, Crosby's Kitchen, Tuco and Blondie, Frasca. And DOC Wine Bar.
Oh, and I'm not going to ask you what your favorites are. You don't want to pit any of your clients against
each
other.
It's really hard to choose. It's really hard.
Well, what I was reading about Smoke Daddy is that they smoke all their own meat on premises.
Yes,
tell
they
us
do.
A little bit about that.
So their kind of mantra for smoking is low and slow. So low temperatures, slow. Take it slow. Averaging about 18 hours of smoking over three different types of wood, hickory, apple, and cherry. It's just phenomenal. We have in-house smokers at both locations.
And as Mallory was saying, one of the reasons that the Smoke Daddy has gotten involved with the Lakeview Supper Club is to be a part of the community and have a place where people can go, get to know each other, and so that you can get to know a little bit about Lakeview, which again is the goal behind the Lakeview Supper Club, one of our great neighborhoods. We got over by there. It's one of our favorites. We love all the neighborhoods in Chicago. It is a destination that you should learn beyond just the everything on Clark and Addison. There's more beyond Wrigley Field.
Yeah. So actually, the Lakeview East area covers from the lake to Racine and then Diversey to Irving Park. So 1,200 businesses are in that area. We have a lot of work to do, but it's a great job to have.
And that's Sammy Saliba, who is the communications manager for Lakeview East Chamber of Commerce. You want to be a part of this club, you got to go to lakeviewsupperclub.com, and it's $10 a year. You get to know about all the great events that they have coming up. I want to thank you both so much for coming in. Thank you for the food, but thank you more importantly for the conversation and sharing such a fun group with us.
Thanks.
Appreciate Thanks for having it. Us.
Look forward to having you back, and have a great evening. We'll talk to you again. Thank you. More after this on 720 WGN. It is Tuesday night. We are hanging out in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're so happy that you're here with us tonight. Hope that you're happy, healthy, and safe wherever you are. Don't forget that everything that we say on this show, and actually every show on WGN Radio, is podcast at WGNradio.com. We would love for you to subscribe to the podcast. You can do that wherever your podcast availability is, iTunes or on iHeart or TuneIn Radio. And if you've been following the show for the last couple of years, you know that during the budget impasse, we had a big budget crisis for a couple of years. Well, actually, I think the budget crisis is ongoing. We just didn't have a budget for a couple of years. And we made some connections with some really, really incredibly gracious legislators who were joining the show. On Friday nights in particular, we had the budget crisis corner with one representative from the Republican side and one from the Democrat side. Joining us on the line with us is Representative Mark Batnick, who was a regular during that time, and we want to continue to have you on the show. We didn't, just because the crisis of that part is over, there's still a crisis going on, isn't there, Representative?
We seem to cream from crisis to crisis, so sure. Which one do you want to talk about?
Well, I think that the one that, well, there's so many, right? But I think that this week what I saw on the schedule was to talk about the pensions. Is that something that you're working on this week? I know there's some committee hearings about what to do next. How involved are you in that process?
So, actually, with another regular on your show, Representative Martwick, he's the chairman, and then I'm the Republican spokesman for the pension committee. So, kind of, yes. I represent the Republicans, lead Republican for that, and he's obviously the big dog in the Democratic Party on pensions. Yeah, and we have a subject matter hearing on kind of tier two fixes and some other things Thursday. So real soon, and we're always talking about pensions.
When you say tier two, I mean, you guys are so into the, you know, weeds when it comes to understanding the stuff and trying to fix this problem. Can you explain what tier two means or any of those tiers so that maybe we can get some insight as to how deep this problem is and what's our way out, if there is one?
Wow. So,
I know.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. But this is probably going to be new news to almost everybody that's listening. So everybody knows about we have this unfunded pension liability that's mainly caused by tier one workers, and those were workers who started their pensions, I want to say before 2011, and then after that, all new state workers had much less generous benefits, and those people started after 2011. So those people are called tier two. People who started working before that are tier one, and most of the big liabilities under the tier one workers. The issue is, even though the big problem is with tier one workers, the federal government may be saying that tier two pensions are so diminished that we may have to give them a little extra money and increase some spending there in order to meet federal regulations. Basically, we have to match at least Social Security, and there are some scenarios where they think we won't even be matching Social Security with tier two pensions. So not only do we have our main thing to fix, but Thursday we're going to be talking about fixing what our fix was, which was tier two. So there you go. A new issue for you. A new crisis corner.
Well, you know, the issue that we had before was the budget, right? Was that it wasn't balanced, or we weren't getting enough money in to pay for all the services and all the different, you know, what makes a state run. And, you know, last week we had Representative Martwick on, and he talked about the fair tax, Governor Pritzker's new idea, this plan to have what would be a fair tax, a graduated or progressive tax. And I see on your website, by the way, we're talking to Representative Mark Batnick. He represents the 97th district. And you have right in the middle of your Facebook page, on your website, it says Pritzker's unfair tax. And you guys are, you know, you're standing up and saying, hey, wait a minute, let's slow our roll here. What is the Republican response to Pritzker's tax?
Well, let's talk about pensions specifically. So we have $135 billion unfunded pension liability. And his, you know, this big tax increase, if that passes, he's promising to pledge $200 million more a year towards our unfunded pension liability. Now, those are a lot of zeros. So what you do is you have to kind of wipe them off to make it even. And to put it into a perspective your listeners and everybody can understand, it's like we have a $13,500 credit card bill, and we're going to add less than $2 a month to knocking down that bill.
That's not good. So, that's not going to get us anywhere.
No. Right. That's the point. And I can tell you, if you look at like the Illinois Retired Teachers Association, they came out blasting his proposal because that's not what it was supposed to be. And frankly, Representative Markwick had proposed something a couple years ago that was much more bold and robust. I have something that I proposed, too. We have to attack this from all angles. And this was a pretty meek first offer. And this is also coming off over the next 5 years. He actually plans on shorting pensions about $900 million a year for the next 5 years, so that $200 million won't even cover the interest on what we're going to short it for the next 5 years. So it's more of the same borrow, spend, tax thing that we've been doing for a long time. And I was disappointed, to be frank.
What is the justification for shorting the pensions by $900 million? And so basically then, if you're only going to pay in $200 million, then you obviously have a deficit there of $700 million of just trying to like make up the difference and not just what we already owe, right?
Exactly.
Oh, my head.
Yeah, the purpose of it is that there's a whole bunch of new spending going on down here in Springfield. I mean, we're spending money like we just won the lottery, and we're on the opposite side of that coin.
How much of that is a debt that we accumulated during the budget impasse when we were writing checks that we didn't know how we were going to pay for?
No, when he talks about the deficit for the year, it doesn't include any of the backlog of bills.
Right. So
that's a whole separate thing. That's $7-8 billion right now. That's a separate line item.
So
this is something different.
So what is the justification that you're getting from the Democrats or from Governor Pritzker to short it, but to then only pay in $200 million, but borrow against it by $900 million? They're saying we have to do this in order to pay for what we need in the state, or how are they?
Yeah, correct. The idea is the pension liability is too big. We have to. It's kind of like it's similar to having a 15 or 20 year loan on your house and stretching it out to a 30-year loan. So he wants to re-amortize it and kind of push our schedule out on paying back that $135 billion of unfunded liability. And if you were doing that in the context of, you know, one of the things that's been talked about is putting, you know, front-loading pensions with a lot of new money and doing some other thing and some other reforms and some spending restraints, if it was part of a big package, that kind of, there is some sensibility there, but it's not. It's just, now we're just going to short it. We're going to spend a bunch of money on other things, and off we go. And I got to tell you, I mean, if you look at my press releases, my statements, I think I was on your show, I was really optimistic coming into this term because the Democrats have to own it. They right. have a supermajority in both houses. They have the governorship, so they can't play games with everything. Like when it's 50-50, both parties play games back and forth. So I figured, all right, I'm looking at a tax increase, but they're going to have some restraint. They're going to have to solve the pension crisis. Some of these problems are going to get fixed, and I'm not seeing it. I'm seeing the spending. I'm seeing the taxes, but I'm not seeing the things that are going to fix the problems that are long-term solutions for the state.
We are talking to Representative Mark Batnick. He represents the 97th District, and we'll talk more in a moment. If you don't mind hanging out, I'd like to continue the conversation. I know that maybe some listeners have some questions or comments. 312-981-7200. I would also like to talk about Stephanie's Law, which is legislation that you're working on as well. Sound good?
Oh, that'd be fantastic. Yeah,
excellent.
I'll be here.
And about the self-defense classes in your community. I love that, too.
Hey, you really are trolling my website.
I'm trolling. Trolling is if I was, like, poking you. I'm just looking at it. I don't think that's trolling.
There you go.
I'm trying to stay up to date on what you're up to. Again, more with Representative Mark.
It.
Of course. More with Representative Mark Batnick when we come back on 720 WGN. Representative Mark Batnick of the 97th District is on the line with us. My producer, Tom Hush, was saying, which one's the one you call the rootin' tootin'? And I said it's the 19th, but I'm not going to hold back and say that the 97th is not rootin' and tootin'. Is the rootin' tootin' 97th work for you, Representative?
We're the Fighting 97th.
The Fighting 97th. All right, there. You can come up with your own. We actually have a listener on the line, Representative, who wanted to join the conversation and share some thoughts with you. Hey, Matthew, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Patty. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Go ahead.
I just want to share with you that we're proud of Mark in our district. I'm from Plainfield, and he fought a really, really hard battle to represent us. And all his blue-collar workers that he represents, we know he's down there fighting for us. And we could not be prouder of you, Mark.
Aw.
Wow, that is great to hear.
Some constituent love.
I appreciate hearing that.
Yeah, we know in the neighborhood, I live in a neighborhood with a lot of blue-collar union guys that voted against their party that, you know, because they knew what you were about. They knew that there wasn't going to be Chicago money coming into our neighborhood taking your votes away. We're proud of you.
Hey, Matthew, if you ever get a chance, have you had a chance to visit Springfield?
I've been down there a few times, Patty. Thank you.
Yeah, if you ever get a chance, you should definitely get down there when the representative is in session so you can watch. I mean, he does a great job of fighting the battles on the floor. Or not. I mean, fighting the battle sounds bad, but I mean, really, you know, sharing his thoughts and having great discussions when it comes to fighting for your district. So I recommend that you down there and watch him when you have a chance.
Yeah, he is quite articulate, and he gets the point across. And he's not partisan. That's what I like about him the most. Because this state is so partisan that to find somebody that's moderate in this state is hard, you know, especially for people that work their tails off day in and day out. It's nice to find somebody that works so hard.
I like to think of him as my favorite Republican wonk down there. He knows his stuff.
No, definitely.
I'm just going to sit back and listen to you guys chat. This is fun.
I appreciate it. I chat to people all night. I bartend for a living, Mark, and like I said, we're glad to have you in representing Plainfield.
Oh, that's great. Matthew, where do
awesome.
You...
Awesome. I got to come in and have a drink at your bar sometime.
Yeah, where do you work, Matthew?
Yeah. I'm at Hardware in North Aurora. I'm the head bartender there. I do all our scratch cocktails and we brew beer.
Oh,
the mom and pop operation. So
outstanding. All right.
So, I'm there.
All right, great, Matthew.
Come visit me, Mark. All right, we'll talk to you later.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Thank you in particular for calling, Representative. We also have a listener who's texting from the 708. By the way, 708, I love you. They want to know if you could speak to the fact of why there are pensions in the first place. Why don't folks who are teachers, policemen, etc., just have Social Security?
So this is an interesting one, and this is, you know, going off the other caller, this is something that I kind of break from the party mantra on. What people don't realize is that if we actually just followed the rules and paid as we went with pensions, it's actually a better deal for the state than Social Security, which is something that most people don't realize. If we tried to switch everybody into Social Security and a 401k, it would actually cost us more than just giving typical pension benefits. The issue hasn't been that necessarily the 3% compounded COLA, that has proven to be a mistake because we've had a lower interest period for decades now. But the fact remains, had we funded pensions properly, it would have been cheaper than paying our share of Social Security. So it's actually savings for the state, but we skipped too many payments is really what the problem has been going along.
So the task ahead of us is to obviously start to be realistic about it. But part of that is also going to be cuts. There's no way around that. What kind of suggestions or ideas do you have in those regards?
There's tons. And one thing I'd like to do is stop spending on new programs. I mean, every day, every bill that seems to be moved is something that's going to cost the state money. I mean, the minimum wage bill is going to cost us probably close to $1 billion a year when you talk about, you know, paying university students more, student workers and all the workers. And there were some that I am certainly like direct service professionals. I certainly think that people, those people deserved raises, and I've been on bills that have given direct service providers raises. But, you know, the kid that's checking, that's tutoring at college doesn't need a living wage. That's not what it was meant for. So we have to stop digging. But, you know, I have a video on my website about pension consolidation that would save us, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in administrative costs, essentially. There's things that we can do to get better returns on our pensions. If you look at higher education, we actually fund higher education per student at one of the highest in the nation, yet we still have to charge our students high tuition because we have so many mandates and laws that make it so expensive for us to do our jobs as government. Procurement reform, and that's what that simply means is purchasing reform. We have a big bureaucracy on just our government agencies purchasing things that we spend money on things that don't necessarily make lives better for people. And we have to make government efficient before we start going and asking the taxpayers for more money. And we're nowhere close to doing that yet.
In addition to trying to be practical, Representative Batnick also is working on some legislation that is near and dear to so many people, in particular when we talk about sexual assault. Tell us a little bit about Stephanie's Law.
So Stephanie's Law was brought to me the first time I was running. Actually, I heard about it, and it was actually a girl that's in my daughter's high school class, or was in my daughter's high school class before she graduated, and she was sexually assaulted. And what the mother found is that so many of these cases, especially with minors, end up going into the battery category. And the problem is that when things come out, especially with minors, that this was battery that was sexually related, they don't go on the sexual predator list. So you have a lot of these cases that end up being charged in court at this level of a crime, and it looks like you might have been in a bar fight. So these people are free to coach kids, be in classrooms, do things in schools. And there's been a lot of stories out there of people who just don't belong in those situations. So this is really about protecting children.
And that's the thing. You know, there's so much that people, you know, gripe about what's going on in Springfield, you know, but when we hear stories about, you know, things that happen perhaps in the school system or, you know, other situations where it could have been prevented by simply categorizing somebody, as you mentioned, as being on the sex offender list, you guys do some really outstanding work in Springfield. So, by the way, the 708 wants to know about the minimum wage. Is $15 for the minimum wage just for full time? I don't believe it is it?
Yeah, no, it's for the only caveat, I think, is there's a teen wage that's at 13. But it's not just for full time. No, it's somebody that's serving ice cream on a Friday night and a Saturday night for extra money in college and stuff. It was way too expensive.
Well, I love the work that you do. I love having conversations with you. And I know that you're busy. You've got a huge workload to get through. Now that the Democrats are in charge and the Republicans, have got sort of this task in front of them to sort of go, hey, let's be realistic about things. I'm always grateful for conversation with you and to make sure that, people do want to feel represented. They often feel like they're only hearing from one side. And you are always just so gracious with your time. And I appreciate that.
I love being on your show. Best show ever.
Well, I look forward to having you in studio, but we'll talk to you on the phone again soon in the next couple weeks and check in.
Sounds terrific. We'll see you soon.
Visit his website. It's repbatnick.com. I've not been trolling it, sir. Just doing my research. That's all. Have a great night.
I understand.
Thanks so much. Take care. Again, that's Representative Mark Batnick. Go to repbatnick.com. BATINICK. More in a moment on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. I'm sorry, Tom. I was looking at this story again about this woman who was taking a selfie while trying to get closer to a jaguar, and then she was attacked. And now there are so many different stories out there as to what actually happened, right? So a lot of us are sort of just hearing it the way I heard about it, which was like partly on Rose's show and then, clickbait on different headlines. There's stories out there that one guy said that he saw her behind this barrier it looked like she was trying to get a selfie. He says that his mom rescued her by shoving a water bottle through the fence, and that distracted the jaguar. The woman who was attacked said that she was not around some other barrier. She said that she did not expect the jaguar to attack her through a fence. The zoo says that she did go, cross a barrier. By the way, it isn't that hard in some places like at Lincoln Park Zoo, there are areas where you could put yourself into real danger. The expectation is that you will not go to extraordinary measures to put yourself in harm, nor would you let your children go, through barriers where they don't belong. Pay attention.
Exactly. I mean, this reminds me of the story from a couple years ago now, the Harambe the gorilla, which
right.
is a lot more tragic, if you ask me, because an animal died that didn't really do anything.
And yep, exactly. Well, in this case, the zoo said that nothing will happen to the jaguar for attacking the woman because the jaguar didn't do anything wrong.
Nope.
She was in the wrong place. But there are people who have died taking selfies, whether it's falling off. Right here in Chicago, there was a comedian. There are people who do like extreme selfing. That the London House, I think somebody fell off of that building, which is actually, by the way, a gorgeous bar. It's like a rooftop bar that's great in the summertime.
Yeah, you'll fall for it.
You will. Exactly. See, you put yourself in a dangerous position. Look, if that's your thing, if that's, extreme selfieing and you want to push the limits, there's going to be consequences.
Yeah, I just cannot fathom the drive, I suppose, to want to get that close to a jaguar. Like,
no.
I just take the picture.
Yes.
And there were some videos out there. It was bad. Like, she got mauled.
Oh, it had her arm, and she's lucky she still has an arm.
Yeah.
Or her life.
Yeah, you saw the meat.
Ugh.
And it was a lot, but, I got to side with the zoo on this one.
It's and like, the jaguar. Well,
and the jaguar.
You are in the wrong place, lady.
Yeah, get out of my house.
Yeah, you are a tossing toy right now. That's ridiculous. Look, people know I take a lot of selfies.
Sure.
I've cut back on the selfie. I call them selfish selfies, right? Because I it takes me a long time to get the look that I like, and I'm being selfish about it. It is a picture of myself. There are places all over the world. They have to put like places where people can take selfies safely because people are too dumb to do it on their own. Like whether it's the Cliffs of Moher, mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. Is it Moher?
I
my
think
niece
so.
Says it correctly.
In Ireland?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And you know, again, in zoos or at the top of a skyscraper, you know, or like one of these tall buildings. It's just, it's ridiculous. There's one kid. Did you see that one where the guy was taking a selfie by the train tracks and the engineer, as they were coming by, smacked him in the back of the head? That's probably my favorite selfie I've ever seen in my entire life.
Well, it just kind of reminds us that people like to use the phrase common sense. And I like to say to them, common sense isn't exactly so common. Even ourselves, sometimes things that others would seem to be like saying, duh, of course you wouldn't do that. It might not strike us as common sense in the time, and hindsight's 20/20.
Well, we live in this sort of bubble of like, what could possibly happen-ness, right? We all think that, mm-hmm. like, well, that couldn't possibly happen to me, or I know what I'm doing. And that happens everywhere, not just with selfies, people who are texting while they're driving.
Right.
They have this idea that, I guess they think that they're, it's not even just invincibility, but I'm fine. I know what I'm doing. I can do this. I'm totally got this. Yeah.
Yeah. You can tell them the statistics all that you want, and they're still going to do it. And recently, you know how they have the signs on all the highways in Illinois that have different phrases and everything reminding you not to text and drive or drink and drive or always wear your seatbelt. Recently, it got circulated that one of those signs said, please stop taking out your phones to take pictures of this sign.
Yes.
And is that not like the ultimate irony that they're trying to get you to stop doing the thing that you're actively doing to like take a picture of?
Yeah.
I really hate people who drive with their phones out. My girlfriend's mom does it, and it drives me insane. Like, she's got the GPS out, like, for even for Christmas I bought her one of the little clips that you put onto the dashboard. I'm like, this is safe, this is in your field of vision. And you'll still take it down and like do stuff with it. I'm like, please stop.
Yeah, we've all got to stop doing that. I would be lying if I said I'd never do that.
And no,
I don't want to be a bad, but I don't want to be a bad example to my son, who will be driving in a year, by the way.
Well, yes. I mean, luckily your son is a very, very bright young man. So,
but he's on that phone all the time, which is what we're going to talk about when we come back. Yeah, he's on that phone all the time. So I've got to be a good example to him. So that's got to be my goal. And actually, it's not even next year. He's eligible to take his the driving class this summer because he'll turn 16 in September.
Yeah.
His birthday is early in September. So he could be the first. Mostly he just wants to get the driver's license, not to drive, but to be the first one that has his license.
Oh, okay. He's that kid.
He is that kid.
Oh.
I know. We're trying to figure out what to do for the summer, by the way. It might be driver's ed, or it might be, he doesn't want to go to debate camp, which is fine by me. There's already enough arguing in my house. I don't need
Now he can bring a structured, formal set of rules into that debate.
Well, I was trying to write sort of the beginning of the show tonight. I was talking about, you know, wealth, privilege, and the status quo, you know, when it comes to these this college cheating scandal.
Naturally.
And he goes, you know, in debate we call it squo. I'm like, okay, I don't need your shorthand for status quo. We call it squo.
Okay. Ah, jeez. Squo. Is that what the kids are calling it nowadays? Back I used to do squo in the bathroom.
Squo.
At rock clubs.
He does debate club. Like, he competes in these it's a marathon of debating. They
it
start
is.
At like 7 in the morning. Sometimes he'll call us at like 6 and say, hey, we made it to another round. 6 p.m.
Oh,
sometimes he's there till 10 or 10:30, and I don't even want to know.
Is it at least on the weekends?
Yes, it's on.
Okay, sometimes it's not school night.
Not on school nights, but he'll start sometimes on a Friday night, then do Saturday, and then if they make it to the next round, come back on Sunday. It's a lot of talking.
That's.
I mean, I know where he gets it from. I understand. Yes, that's entirely clear to me. But he's taking it to the competitive level. Well, let's talk a little bit more. We'll talk a little bit more about my son and your sons, or your boys and girls, or yourselves. We want to talk about how people are using their phones in ways we really, really wish they wouldn't, and maybe we do it, and it's kind of gross. How are you? Well, now I made that weird. Well, we have to find out what I mean when we come back. It's the Patty Vasquez Show, 720. WGN. More in a moment. Don't forget, check in with us, call or text 312-981-7200. There was a study done in England that revealed the staggering amount of time that people spend on their phones and where they spend time on their phones. And I think this will apply for us as well. I know that it applies in my house, and not just, you know, I'm going to talk about Griffin and how much time he spends on the phone. But to say that, you know, he's the one you know, using a lot of screen time, that would be disingenuous because I think I was a bad influence there. I really, you know, because for work, and I use that as an excuse. I'm looking for stories or, you know, communicating with people and trying to figure out what we're going to talk about at night. But I kind of feel like I set a bad example. So I've got to straighten up, and hopefully it's not too late, because I don't want him to be this guy who, one, will delay or refuse having sex with somebody so they can use their phone. What? No, come on. How?
It's to be fair, it's fairly small. It's like, what, 14%?
Between 14% so they had even answered a phone. Two-thirds, Tom. Two-thirds of 25 to 34-year-olds say they delayed or refused sex so they could use their phones, while 14% said they had even answered a phone call during the throes of passion.
Here's the compromise. You get your Bluetooth headset in. You put a little Marvin Gaye on in the background. You got your Bluetooth headset in. Yes, boss.
Okay.
I'll have that TPS report to you in the morning.
Not okay. Not okay to do. And if you're the other person, the other thing is that, one, you're not feeling too special because they'd rather be on the phone with whoever that is, even if it is their boss. But what if it's somebody else? What if it's your friend? What if it's your mom? Your mom calls while you're in the middle.
I'm not saying I would do it, but I would not. I don't know if I would be offended if someone did that to me.
Together, mom's on the phone right there with you.
I'm just thrilled to be in the situation.
Okay,
if we're being honest.
See,
and if she's got to take a call from mom, you know, maybe it's an emergency. You know,
you've introduced an element that I've been trying to convince audiences when I do stand up comedy. I feel like there used to be a time when people were just happy to be invited to the party of fleshiness.
Sure.
The flesh party. Because when I was young, I've been with my husband for 24 years. It seems like there are new requirements now for people who are new to a relationship, in particular maintenance when it comes to the woman's body. But I'm not going to get into it. We're talking about phones. Well, I'll tell you off that. You still want to know what my last name is, which just cracks me up.
Yeah, I'm very curious.
Yeah, you can't have it. it's not that big of a deal. But the one that bothers me though, okay, we don't have to talk too much about people answering the phone during sex, but being in the bathroom much longer than you have to be because you're on the phone. I don't know if it's like my dad was like this with the baseball encyclopedia. My mom ended up buying. We used to have in the 80s and 90s. Some people still have this.
Well, the Uncle John's bathroom reader.
Yeah, no, but the exactly. You gotta alert all
the cushioned seats.
The cushioned seats.
Oh yeah.
My mom. We had a cushioned seat, and my mom got rid of it. She bought like a wooden seat with like brass hardware, just to like remind my father that he was sitting on the hardest thing possible to get him out of the bathroom. Oh, he would be in there forever with the baseball encyclopedia. But now, so I feel as though my son has that genetic side to him where he's got to hear. You can hear videos. He's playing some sort of YouTube commentary on something, or he's reading some, because he'll come out of the bathroom, you know, yelling about our trade deal with China or something. And I'm like, could you just do what you need to do in the bathroom? Could you just not?
But people are, I don't know. I will say that I've noticed a difference between men and women.
Okay.
In terms of, now I think both parties do the phone thing, more frequently now. However, I think men have always been more prone to getting the magazine, the paper, Uncle John's bathroom reader out when they're sitting because they're not used to it. Usually, if it's number one, it's kind of
right.
In and out. You're done in about
sure.
30 to 45 seconds.
Oh, because we sit more?
Yeah, women sit more. So that's like not new to them. For men, it's like, oh, wow, this is so relaxing. And then you're like, what can I do now that my hands are free? I can hold on. It used to be the shampoo bottle.
Okay.
You'd read the back of the shampoo bottle.
See, now I was about to tell you something very personal, but then you said it. I have to say that in order to relax, especially if I'm in somebody else's place, I have to be reading something.
Totally.
But before there were phones, it was the shampoo bottle.
Yeah.
Why did we read the shampoo bottle?
It was the only, it had a long list of ingredients and it told you a lot about a person. Because you'd be
what smell they like.
Yeah, they're like, oh wow, they're really into lavender.
Oh, they like strawberry in their shower.
Head and Shoulders,
I can't believe you said it's the shampoo bottle. That's exactly what I used to do.
That is so universal, you'd be shocked.
Yeah, but not anymore.
Not
because
anymore.
We have our phones.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to read the shampoo bottle if I can read the New Yorker on my phone. Learn a little something.
All those poor people making those labels for shampoo bottles are now going greatly underappreciated.
All those English grads. Got a job at L'Oreal.
All those chemists who figured out what combination that they could make it smell like that and lather up like that. Now we no longer appreciate what they're doing. But this the study in England says that the you know, by the way, the incessant phone use does interfere with communication flow. But I have to say, I wonder if it interrupts other kinds of flow, because once you're done, I mean, if you're sitting there too long and giving that kind of effort, it can't be healthy, both for your body and your relationships. But sometimes, man, I just I wish I had another bathroom in my house, because Griffin really does spend. And look, sometimes I worry, like, is everything okay? You know, maybe I'm judging him because I think he's on the phone. Maybe I should be like, hey, is everything? But what would he tell me? Would he actually be honest with me if I was like, sweetie, is everything going on okay digestively? I don't want to be that mom either. You know, like I figure he's a smart enough kid. He'll tell me when he needs to. But we're talking about reading while on the throne, and Glenn had some thoughts to share with us. Hey, Glenn, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing all right, thank you. I hope my son never hears the show, is what I want to tell you.
When I lived in California, we used to have a wallpaper in the bathroom that was like the old newspaper print. And I would sit on the toilet and read the wall. It was the same old stuff, but it was interesting.
Right?
You know, just something to read, you know.
There's something.
I never read a shampoo bottle, but no.
I kind of need to know who the other shampoo bottle readers are out there, because I cannot believe that Tom said that. I did not see that coming. I was a shampoo bottle reader from way back. Whatever. But you were the wallpaper. You like the newspaper wallpaper. Was it old fashioned, like an old fashioned newspaper, like from the '20s or something?
Yeah. It was the print of the wallpaper, and that's what it was. And I don't know how many times I read this stupid thing, but you just keep on reading it. You know, they should bring it back.
There you go. That sounds like some nice novelty newspaper wallpaper, yes.
I believe in a future where the wallpaper will, you know, we've got so much technology, it'll refresh every day.
Yeah, but now we're talking Fahrenheit 451 stuff. Yeah. Where walls are just digital. Yeah, that's a little scary.
Well, remember the old Sears catalog.
No. Yeah. Yeah. See what's on sale.
You read it and used it.
Yeah.
You know? Right.
It's so absorbent. Have a great night, Glenn. Be well.
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Right,
talk to you again soon. And the, hold on a second. By the way, 708 says the shampoo bottle is still good if your battery in your phone goes dead or you just forget to bring your phone with you when you sit down. Okay, so you and I are not alone. Well, yeah. It stands to reason. You and I only started working together here a couple years ago, so there are other people in the universe. We've crossed paths. Yeah. For
there
a
are literally dozens of us.
Probably. We should start a club. Shampoo bottle readers from way back. The 847 says, love you, Patty. Thank you. I love you too, 847. Make your son get a message regularly or he will overload long-term anxiety. Get it. Oh, massage.
Massage.
Oh. I don't. That. You know what's interesting about that? I actually saw him rubbing his own shoulders. Quick break here. More in a moment. He was rubbing his own shoulders. He knows he's stressed. More in a moment on 720 WGN. You are listening to WGN Radio. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez, and I am thrilled to welcome in studio Patrick Radden Keefe, who has written Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. And Patrick, I know it's already been kind of a long day. How long have you been touring so far, giving interviews on this new book?
Just about a week.
Just about a week?
A little over a week ago, yeah.
And so when you write the book, obviously you've written so many other pieces, whether it's for The New Yorker or, you know, the work that you've, and you've been doing so much research and compiling this. This isn't really the goal, is to like go to every single interview possible, but it's so important, part of the process in a weird way too, isn't it?
It is, yeah, especially because this is a book about the troubles in Northern Ireland, which is not necessarily front of mind for people today. So part of it for me is just going out there and banging the drum and saying, you know, I grew up in Boston, I was Irish American, I didn't really know all that much about what had gone on during the troubles, and I was just amazed when I got into it by the stories of these people. So it's going out and trying to persuade people that they should
pay attention.
Yeah, they should pay attention.
Well, it's funny, and we'll get to a question that my husband made me write out a little bit later.
Yeah.
Because you know, in a strange way, I didn't, for me, it was background noise too. I mean, there, you know, obviously so many Americans are like, oh, my great grandmother, Maggie O'Doyle, okay. was from Ireland. And my father didn't really have that many stories about her, but the Irish are so, you know, eager to tell their story yeah. in so many different ways, right? But this one, we don't really understand. This isn't one that necessarily is something that's, as you mentioned, accessible to us. So I think that's probably a decent place to start, because I watch Dairy Girls, which uh-huh. I know is so, you know, it's a great, goofy show, yeah. but you know, there was a line in one of the later episodes where they have this girl that's supposed to be from the nuclear fallout, uh-huh. right, from Russia, and she's like, why are you all fighting? You're all just different shades of the same, you know, it's yeah. the same religion. People really don't necessarily understand what was going on in Northern Ireland between the Unionists and the Protestants, the Catholics, what it meant.
Sure.
You want to tell us a little bit about what that strife was like leading into the 60s all the way to 1998.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there had been, you know, you can go back almost 1,000 years
sure.
and people were leaving England to, you know, cross that thin channel and go to Ireland and try and take over parts of it. And at various times during history, England had total dominion over Ireland. You ended up getting the Irish War for Independence, which happened in the 1920s. And after that, the island of Ireland was partitioned so that in the south, you had the big part of the island, which is the Republic of Ireland. It's an independent country. But in the north, you had these six counties, which remained part of the United Kingdom. And in those counties, it was majority Protestant, whereas in Ireland of the South, it was majority Catholic.
Okay.
And the minority, the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland, was really pretty oppressed. They didn't have great civil rights, didn't have a lot of job opportunities, didn't have a lot of housing opportunities. There's a great deal of discrimination. So a lot of what they did was they just left. And this is the part of the reason you get so many Irish Americans, right, is that people left. They left in the 19th century. They left in the 20th century. There's 30 million people in America who claim Irish heritage, which is way more people than live in Ireland today. And that's kind of a testament to the fact that all these people left. And in the late 1960s, you had a period of time when, you know, revolution is happening all over the world, and the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, which had been around for a long time, kind of evolved into a much more aggressive organization. And the idea was, we are going to stick it to the British and try and get them out. And as that happens, you also get terrorist groups that are Unionist or Loyalist terrorist groups, which are Protestant, loyal to the crown. You get the police, you get the British Army comes in. And so it was this kind of multi-vector conflict for decades that was just grinding along, this kind of long-running war right in Europe, in which 3,600 people were killed.
And, you know, you also talk, I mean, there's such great storytelling in this, and obviously it's part biography, part politics, part history. But, you know, the personal stories are, of course, Jean McConville,
yeah.
who was abducted and murdered, and the discovery of her body in 2003, you know, this incredible mystery. How many people were abducted and mysteriously buried? Was it about 18 people?
Just a little over a dozen. So, right. I mean, this is the funny thing, right? There's this tactic, which is forced disappearances, which is when you know, you don't just kill somebody, but you bury them in a secret grave and nobody knows what happened to them. In Latin America, this happened in huge numbers, thousands and thousands of people. But Northern Ireland is tiny.
Mm-hmm.
So it was only ever, about 16, 18 people. And one of them was this woman, Jean McConville. And so what I did with the book was, I didn't want to write a history of the Troubles.
Right.
I wanted to write this almost more like you would write a novel, where you tell a story about, they're real people, but, you know, about half a dozen characters. And one of them is this woman, Jean McConville, who was a 38-year-old mother of 10 in 1972. She was a widow. And one night, a gang of people came into her house and took her out. Her kids were screaming. They were clinging to her legs. And they never saw her again. And that's where the book starts. And it tells the story of her family and the victims of that act, but also the perpetrators, also the people who did that.
Well, and you talk about the Price sisters who, you know, they grew up like learning how to make these makeshift bombs, you
yeah.
know, and to even imagine that that's what your dad would be, that's how you would spend time together.
It's yeah.
so bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing for me looking at kind of political radicalism. And there had been this long tradition in Ireland, Northern Ireland, of you know, Irish Republicans, people who thought it's our duty to get rid of the British by any means necessary. And so these two sisters, Dolores and Marion Price, who are some of the big characters in the book, yeah, when they were little girls, their dad, who had himself been in the IRA, would, you know, put them on his knee and tell them stories about friends of his who'd been hanged by the British and how he went off himself to bomb the British, and he would tell them the recipe for mixing an IED.
Wow. And that's the thing. And for the way they grew up, you know, and you think about the sort of trajectory of, you know, the things that you do when you're young and now dealing with it. It's, you know, you kind of, as you mentioned, growing up in Boston, knowing something about the Troubles in Ireland, for many of us, we don't really pay that much attention. I was startled when I read that that Jean McConville was born in 1934, because my father would have just been 1 year older than her.
Yeah.
So it's, it, you know, this is all so recent, so intensely, you know, fresh.
Yeah.
And she had 14 children.
Yeah.
Jean had lost four.
Right.
And the 10 children were, what were their age range? Like, some of them didn't even have an opportunity to have very many memories of her.
Right. So the oldest child was 20, and the youngest were two twins who were 6 years old. So they didn't, you know, this is one of the weird things about this story. So in adulthood, the younger kids, some of them couldn't even remember what their mother had looked like. There's one photo of her that survives, and of course they know that photo and what she looks like there. But apart from that photo, some of them couldn't really remember her face. But because Belfast is so tiny, one really strange feature of this story is that they do remember the faces of the people who took her away.
Oh, no.
And they see those people around the city, because those people have grown up too and had families of their own. There's a story in the book about Michael McConville, who is one of Jean McConville's children, as an adult, hailing a taxi one night and getting into the back seat of this black taxi, and the taxi pulls away from the curb, and Michael looks in the mirror and he realizes the guy driving the taxi is one of the people who took his mother away.
It's so chilling, and there's so much mystery in this, and you along the way, you know, are pulling this apart, unraveling it. How much, when you talk to people like Michael, I mean, what was it like for them to have these conversations with you? I know you didn't talk to all the kids.
Yeah, it was hard.
Yeah,
it was hard.
I mean,
these people are incredibly traumatized even now, and a lot of them have struggled. You know, they struggled as children. They were all orphaned and sent off to different orphanages, and a lot of them have struggled as adults. And I think these stories are pretty raw. And so, look, those weren't easy conversations at all. And it's hard, right? Because on the one hand, I feel great sympathy with them. On the other hand, I'm out here kind of trying to tell the true story as I can find it. And I think there's a virtue in that, right? So this was sort of the way it was with everyone. The book's called Say Nothing, right?
Right.
A lot of this stuff people don't want to remember. They don't want to talk about it. But I think that I think there's a service in going out there and trying to figure out what happened and explore that.
Well, and as you mentioned, living in the community together, you know, and with what might be coming down the road, we don't know what's going to happen next. And that's part of what I want to talk to you about more. Before we get to that, though, how did you start with emails? Did you start with phone calls? I mean, writing letters? What was the best approach to, I mean, every single person is going to respond differently.
Yeah.
Course.
I mean, I interviewed more than 100 people for the book.
Yeah.
So over the course of 4 years, and I made 7 trips to Northern Ireland. So I approached different people in different ways. I mean, there were a lot of the time, it helped to find intermediaries. You know, sometimes I wouldn't go right to somebody. I'd go to somebody else that they trusted and just make the case for why I thought they should talk to me. And I'm an outsider, which in some ways was a disadvantage, but in some ways was an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, when you go to a place like Belfast, when people there, the minute they open their mouths, everyone around them immediately forms judgments about who they are. You know, you hear the accent and you're like, okay, I know roughly where you are. I know what religion you are. I can probably take a guess at your politics. And so for me, the advantage was coming with, you know, I have an Irish name, but an American accent. They kind of couldn't plot me on the grid, you know, and there were some instances in which that hurt me, but a great many in which I think it actually helped. It made people more willing to tell me their story because they figured I didn't walk in with an agenda.
A neutral sort of perspective. We are talking to Patrick Radden Keefe. He is the author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. He's making the rounds all over the country talking about this book and something exciting that just happened over the last couple of days that we'll talk about when we come back. I also want to talk about Brexit and what that might mean for Ireland. This is the long question that my husband, he was like, excellent. Okay, this is what I want you to ask him. So we'll talk about that when we come back on the Patty Vasquez Show, 720 WGN.
Clear is the water that flows from the boyne, but my love is fairer than any.
You're listening to the Patty Vasquez Show. We are live. Well, we're not live. I'm going to be honest, Patrick. I don't like to lie to people and tell them that we pre-recorded this because you are so busy. We're talking to Patrick Radden Keefe. He's the author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland, with part of the focus on Jean McConville, who was abducted and later found in a grave in 2003. She was abducted in
1972
and discovered, oh my God, it's just the life these children and her 10 children had to have endured, not knowing what happened to their mom. And as you mentioned in our last segment, some of them only remember the abductors.
Yeah.
She was, they were in an apartment building in these flats, and people heard some of the disturbance, but was it because, you know, it's just a loud building and she had a lot of kids that nobody really even thought to come out and check?
No, it was worse than that. I mean, this was it was interesting. So they were a mixed family. Jean McConville was a Protestant woman who was married to a Catholic man, and they had lived in East Belfast, which was more Protestant, and they were at the beginning of the Troubles. They were driven out of their home in East Belfast because they were too Catholic to be in that part of town. So then they end up in West Belfast in a very Catholic area, and there they're kind of too Protestant. They were sort of outsiders, and the building where they were was a huge housing project called Divis Flats, and the IRA was dug in there.
Okay.
And so what happened was that when she was taken away, nobody intervened to stop this from happening. And in fact, after she left, her children, it's heartbreaking, they wanted to stay in the apartment because they were convinced she was going to come back. And so they thought, we have to be here when she gets back. And you would think that the neighbors or others or the church would have realized, you have this apartment full of kids taking care of themselves, and stepped in to help. Nobody did. And I think it's for complicated reasons. It was a crazy, violent time. It was just a frightening time in Belfast. But also, there was a sense that the IRA had done this. The IRA had taken Jean McConville away, and nobody wanted to cross the IRA. So the kids end up getting split up and sent off to orphanages. And these were pretty horrendous institutions where more awful things happened to some of these children. So it was difficult. And they grew up with this kind of in a sort of a purgatory of uncertainty, not knowing what happened to their mother, not having a body to bury. And then finally, in 2003, there's a guy walking along a beach in the Republic of Ireland, and he sees some bones sticking out of the sand. And the authorities came, and they found a skull with a single bullet hole in it. And that was Jean McConville.
And she had the nappy pin still attached to her.
Yeah.
Clothing?
So the story is that, and I mentioned that the children, some of them don't remember what she looked like. What they do remember is that one thing she always wore was a safety pin, a blue safety pin. They call it a nappy pin because nappy is the word for diapers there.
Right.
And you can imagine if you're the mother of 10 kids, you know, it's useful to everybody's, people are losing a button. You've got other reasons why you would.
I know. When I read that, I was like, how smart.
Exactly.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. It's the sort of thing you can relate to. And that was something they always remembered about her. And she disappears in 1972. And in 2003, this body is discovered. And they thought it might be Jean McConville. And they actually they took a DNA sample. But before they got the results from that, they had some of her children come to a police station. And when they found the bones, there were clothes with them. There was some clothing. And they asked one of her sons, Archie, to come in and see if he could identify the clothes. And so he came in. And this is a grown man.
Right.
And he was 16 when his mother was taken away. And he found that he couldn't look at them. He couldn't bring himself to look at the clothes. He said, I don't want to see them. But he said, tell me something, though. Is there a nappy pin in the clothes. Mm-hmm. And the police officer said, yeah, there is. And that was when they knew it was their mother.
This is something that is, as you mentioned before, an important story to tell. And I have to wonder, how did you come across the story of Jean McConville, this family, this abduction and murder?
So I actually came upon it in 2013. And I should say, this is a famous case in Northern Ireland.
In Ireland,
I mean,
right.
Yeah, there are many, many victims of the Troubles, but Jean McConville is one of the most famous of them because it's such an extreme case. I had never heard of it. And in my day job at The New Yorker, you know, I'm always casting around looking for interesting stories. And in 2013, there was an obituary in The New York Times for a woman named Dolores Price, who I mentioned earlier, who was the first woman to join the IRA as a real frontline soldier. And she had lived this very colorful, kind of dramatic life that in some ways sort of stretched from the beginning of the Troubles right to the end. And in this obituary, it mentioned that in the final years of her life, she was really traumatized by some of the things she'd done when she was young. She started speaking out. She started kind of defying the code of silence that the IRA had. And one of the things that she acknowledged having been involved in was the abduction and murder of Jean McConville. And so it was, interestingly enough, I mean, for me, the whole the seed for this book was right there in that obituary, because you had the story of these two women, one a victim, one a perpetrator. And I thought that there might be a way to use those stories and the kind of intersection between the two of them to tell a bigger story about the Troubles.
And what do you hope people learn from the bigger story of the Troubles? I mean, as we head into, and I feel like I have to ask the longer question,
yeah,
I guess,
please.
Right? Yeah. So with all the trips you've made to Ireland for research on this book and the recent developments regarding Brexit, do you have a sense that opening up and examining these atrocities might allow for better dialogue in the face of the hard border returning to Ireland? Will there be a better dialogue, or will old animosities return?
It's a great question. I mean, one thing I became very convinced of is that you might want to try and bury the past, but it won't stay buried. And I think that you have this landmark peace agreement in 1998 in Northern Ireland, which appeared to end the Troubles. But part of that agreement was that there was no real discussion of what happened in the past. How do we deal with the past? There was no truth and reconciliation process, no discussion of how to address what had happened during those decades of violence. And I think if that was an effort to sweep it under the rug, it didn't really work. These things keep coming back. And interestingly enough, I actually think when you look at something like Brexit, part of what was happening there was that voters in the UK forgot about the Troubles. They forgot about the Irish border. They just forgot. They forgot that this was a tense issue, that this was this long-running war right there in their backyard that had gone on for decades. And they forgot that the Irish border, which today you can drive across and not even know it, used to be this fortified border, this huge flashpoint. So the crazy idea with Brexit is, if in fact the UK leaves the European Union, they're going to have to reinscribe that Irish border.
Yep.
Because that will be the border of the UK. It'll be the only land border between the EU and the UK. And I do worry that if that happens, you will see at least a return of some violence. I don't think there's an alarmist version of this story, which is that the Troubles are going to come back full force. I don't think anybody's got the appetite for that.
Because there are listeners who have said, we've talked about this. On Friday nights, we try to talk about the big stories in the news. I can't do it every day because it's like drinking from a fire hydrant.
It's awful.
Yeah. But we've had listeners who are like, you guys are overblowing this. It's going to be no big deal. You can go back and forth to Northern and Southern Ireland, no problem. When I was in Dublin, people were talking about how much nicer things have gotten.
Oh,
even
it's changed so much.
Over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't think it's going to be all, butterflies and unicorns.
Well, the trouble is that, look, if you have, depending on where if you have a customs union, you need to have some way of checking what comes in and out. And if that's a border, even if it's not sandbags and guys with guns, if it's customs inspectors, the symbolism of the Irish border, it was the border crossings, that was where the IRA snipers used to lurk to try and go after the people who were manning those crossings. So I just think it's going to, it's like picking a scab, basically. Yeah. And I don't know what that will mean, but I don't think it's going to mean anything good.
We are talking to Patrick Radden Keefe. He's the author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. And when he came in, I had just read that his book was optioned by the same producers who did the O.J. Simpson movies, the like the limited series and the assassination of Gianni Versace. And this is an interesting way, I think, and I hope that, you know, that Hollywood is so crazy, but congratulations on that and the opportunity to tell this story of all of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I was excited. I mean, Nina Jacobson and Brad Simpson, the producers, are people I've known for a while, and I have just the highest regard for them. And they were really fascinated by this story and felt as though the history of the Troubles would be interesting to explore through the lives of these characters.
And the role of women in that movement.
Absolutely. Right. And that's a, you know, that's an aspect that is women are often written out of the history of the Troubles. And so I think the part of the appeal was telling the story of some of these women who ended up being kind of critical symbols of those years. And they're very, you know, Brad and Nina also did the, you know, they did the Hunger Games and they did Crazy Rich Asians and they're doing, The Goldfinch. They're book people, which I so even though those projects are all very different in terms of the way they look, I feel as though they're very true to the books at the heart of them. So that gives me a lot of confidence.
Well, it's a detail. I think that they, you know, everything from what's the prosecutor's name from O.J. Simpson from talking about her hair. I mean, like
Marcia Clark.
Those small moments, and sometimes those are the most important moments.
Absolutely.
You know, well, I want to thank you for. Well, I'm you know grateful that obituary appeared in 2013 that you seized upon an important story that needed to be told. And again, congratulations on all of it.
Well, thank you.
And yeah, this is something that will continue. And please check out the book again. It's Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. There's mystery, there's politics, there's religion, there's so much that we still don't understand. And I think this sheds such an incredible light on it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Get some rest at some point.
Yeah, I'll do it. I'll do it.
More after this on 720 WGN. Working on a nine moon. Got some listeners who are calling and texting about our interview with Patrick Radden Keefe. That's Patrick R-A-D-D-E-N Keefe, K-E-E-F-E. And again, the book is Say Nothing, and we'll make sure that podcast, Tom will have the podcast up and available so that you can also listen to the interview again or share it with anybody. He was a great interview. It was a pleasure to talk to him.
Oh, so enlightening.
And his voice. I was like, talk some more.
It's very rare that a writer speaks the way that they write.
I agree. There's some people that just knock my socks off when it comes down to having an interview. You don't know how it's going to go. I had gotten his book. I read as much of it as I could before the interview. It's such a tragic story. You know, this story of this Protestant woman who married a Catholic and already going through so much in their lives. They actually had 14 children all together. They lost four children. He died when he was very young. She was a widow. But Patrick was so insightful. And I was just looking up his bio. He also has a law degree, or at least went to Yale Law School, and he's an incredible writer. Now he's sold this series to this book as a series to the folks who did the O.J. Simpson mini, you know,
which does that excite. When I heard that, I'm excited because I would love to see this dramatized. Mm-hmm. I think there's kind of a dearth of film and television specifically focused on the Troubles. Like, we've seen a lot more over the years.
Right.
Some of the big standards, like In the Name of the Father, everybody knows that.
Sure.
The Wind That Shakes the Barley. But still, I would say in the United States, there is
Dairy Girls. That's all we got.
Dairy Girls.
That's all
but
we got.
A lot of people you talk to really don't know a lot about the Troubles, and it's an incredibly significant moment in Western history.
Yeah. And as he mentioned, something going right in the backyard of England. And, you know, today, I believe that Theresa May's proposition, her version of Brexit was voted down. So we'll see what's going to happen next. So again, the book was Say Nothing, and it's available anywhere you can purchase books, and he's done some great writing. He also writes for The New Yorker, so I encourage you to check out more of what he's done. Some wonderful texts coming in. We were talking earlier about Griffin. I also I want to thank our friend Squat, who said, as a listener from the beginning, I believe that you've transferred your relationship with Griffin from his loving and very talented qualities to I'll see you when you'll love me again at 20. Yeah, so that sort of gap of teenagerdom. Although he I will say this, Squat. The other day I was just kind of in a rush, trying to plan my day, and I was just feeling scattered, and Griffin asked me if I wanted a hug. So, no, my teenage boy still hugs me. He doesn't hang out on the couch and hold my hand like he did just about a year and a half ago when we would watch movies. He would still hold my hand. I don't know if that's ever going to come back, and maybe that's weird for a man and his mom, because he is 15 with a mustache and a little goatee growing in. So,
oh yeah,
there you go. He's writing a script about a student council. I don't know if it's a movie or intended to be a pilot episode of the intrigue of student council.
Huh.
I know. It's quite good, actually.
Glenn Griffin, Glenn Ross.
Something along those lines. I wanted to get your advice on something I'm writing. I won't go into any detail, but, you know, when I write characters, especially when it's a script with a female lead, I don't know that I've written anything with a male lead. Anyway, just my point of view.
No, you got to write what you know.
I write what I know. And so I talk to myself a lot. I don't know if I've ever talked to you about this, but I taught, like, in order to sometimes motivate myself, I actually have to tell myself, okay, you've got to do this now, or mm-hmm. I start talking myself through things. I think it also helps with the pressure of how many voices I have inside my head to let at least one of them out to mm-hmm. hear it. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't know if it works in a movie. I don't know if I like it. I started writing the scene. I didn't feel like my character would say any of the things that she wants to say to anybody in her life. So and I don't like the sort of tool of how she has a dog, right? Mm-hmm. But when I started doing stand-up comedy, I would do it to my cats. I would walk back. So it sort of reminded me of that, but I don't think I'm liking it in my script. As somebody who is a connoisseur and critic of films, mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of any scenes that it has worked in that you might have liked it in, or as a tool, do you think it's just cheap?
Well, it kind of depends on how it plays out in the movie. I mean, there's plenty of great films that have used things like narration, of course, is a very common tool. Like Martin Scorsese uses narration all the time.
Right.
And it usually works. So it's gotten a little played out, but usually it still works as a narrative device.
And when he has someone talk to themselves, they're crazy. You talking to me?
Yeah.
You talking to me?
Exactly. Like,
so that's not good. She's not crazy.
I guess it depends on what the goal for you is.
Right.
Are you trying to, by having them talk to themselves, are you trying to have them convey a specific emotion or character trait? Because
she's trying to convince herself to do something, mm-hmm. and she doesn't want to tell her friends what it is she's trying to convince herself of, because they're in a bad situation and she's in a good situation.
Yeah.
So she can't tell them, because she can't complain to them about what she's trying to go through, because mm-hmm. it would cheapen their experience.
I think something to keep in the back of your head is that writing for film and writing for television as well, but specifically for film, we have to remember it's a visual medium.
Right.
So anything that you can say visually without words is always more interesting. It's the show don't tell sort of quote unquote rule. Now, rules are made to be broken. There's plenty of great movies that are very wordy, very dialogue heavy, that mm-hmm. are great to listen to, or great to watch and listen to that dialogue flow. But I am of the school of thought that if you can show a character trait or a thought or an idea through performance or something, or like camera work, that sort of thing, that's always the better route to go. So perhaps in the script you would want to maybe give some sort of action to what the character is doing,
and
that would describe through performance
the anxiety. Well, and it's funny that you say that, because I've been trying to re-edit and make sure that I'm not giving, because the director then, I mean, it is about what the action is, but it also in ways the director also can work with, instead of, you know, being told what they have to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's the thing about writing scripts, is that there's multiple ways to skin a cat. There's no one way to do it.
Yes, now I got to save the cat and skin the cat, Tom? What are we doing here?
Okay,
do you have a problem with Save the Cat?
I'm going to throw it out there. Throw away that book. Because it helps you write scripts that are very, very pitchable.
Yes.
And it has very good jumping off points. And mm-hmm. I think that the author has points to make. And it's just a book. It's just his point of view on how to write a script. However, I think it is very single-minded and does not open up itself to the possibility of what a movie can look like or can sound like.
Yes. Yeah. Because if you're hitting your beat sheets, if you're like, I have to do this by page 11. For those of you who don't know, there's a script writing book called Save the Cat. And the idea behind it is you give the character something that shows you why you like them. Why they're like, I believe he uses the Sea of Love with Al Pacino when they have all these people who think that they've won free tickets to a Yankees game or some baseball game. Mm-hmm. And really what they're doing is they're all out on warrant. They're all there. They're all going to be arrested. For whatever reason, the police have set up this sort of ambush. But then there's one guy who shows up late with his kid, and he thinks he's there to win tickets, and Al Pacino kind of lets him off the hook there. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, we're not gonna arrest you in front of your kid. So he's saving the cat. He saves the dad by not arresting him in front of his kid.
And the thing about trying to ascribe any sort of pattern or formula to any work of art is that it's rare that it fits 100% of the time, because you watch 100 films, and you're just like, all right, I think we're going with a three-act structure, and these are the beats, and this is how you want to do it. We have lots of writings on this, like Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey.
Right.
It's kind of a monomyth, something that can be ascribed to pretty much any story. But then you get the ones that fall out of the mold. And really, those are the ones that are a little bit more interesting, and those can be a little bit more fun to watch. Like The Godfather, the first like 30 minutes to an hour of that is a wedding. It's like a literal wedding.
Yeah.
And all it is building character. It's just building character, setting up that you like this family, even though they're gangsters, they're killers, they're up to no good, but it builds that trust in them. And, you know, movies would rarely take that opportunity now.
Yeah, I agree. And that's the thing, too, is I keep going back and forth. I'm lucky. This isn't a movie I'll have to pitch. This is something that I'm working with a producer on, and she's reading the pages I try to do it every few weeks. I don't want her to be on top of it. When I used to work with a writing partner, we had an open document. So we would go back and forth, and it worked out. That actually worked out really well. But since she's not collaborating on it, just giving her feedback, and she's going to produce and direct it. She only gave me, like, so far, honestly, out of the first 35 pages, just one note. She asked me to just write in that, to let something land for a little bit. I was
that's good, because I can give you my thoughts as much as, you know, until the cows come home. But at the end of the day, if you've got two people such as yourselves that are working together and it's feeling good and it's coming along and you're at a good pace and you feel positive about it, then just keep going with that feeling. Chase the feeling, because if you overthink it, then you're just going to turn into someone like me, who's just watching film essays on YouTube till like 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, what does it all mean?
Yeah, you gotta start writing that. I wrote everything by hand when I wrote my first several scripts. Mm-hmm. I wrote them all, everything by hand. I have like an entire notebook. I would start out with like, what does this character think, like her whole background, her journal. I would journal for her and stuff like that. They call it the Bible, for those who haven't. Some writers have a Bible, like Dan Aykroyd. Apparently his Bible for Blues Brothers is like 10,000 pages or something ridiculous.
There's some legendary production notebooks.
Yeah. So, but I will say this, you're right, because that scene where I'm writing and I started thinking, do I have her talk to herself? I started out with, I'm just going to have her show, right? It's the second time we see her by herself. And part of it is showing, like, she's with all these people. She's always surrounded by people. But at home, at the end of the day, she's always by herself.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's actually better silent now that I'm thinking about it.
And that reminds me of a scene we already referenced, Taxi Driver, when Travis is talking to himself in the mirror. In the script, it literally just said, Travis talks to himself. There's no dialogue.
Oh.
There's no screen direction.
What?
It literally, Scorsese, and that was a case where Scorsese did not write the script. That was just Paul Schrader. Paul Schrader wrote Taxi Driver. And it just says that. And Scorsese and De Niro worked together to be like, what does that mean? How does this fit with the character? And now we have the iconic line, you talking to me?
Oh,
isn't
you know what?
Wonderful?
I'm going to take all the dialogue out and say that Carrie talks to herself.
Yeah.
Thank you for this writing session, Tom.
Anytime,
I appreciate it.
Anytime.
We might do it again. I'm only on page 35. More in a moment. When we come back, what we meant to get to on the Patty Vasquez Show, you know what? You want to hang out and see what we didn't talk about yet. There were so many things, so many stories, and we didn't get to it. More in a moment on 720 WGN.
Didn't have time for it. We didn't have time to talk about it. It did not make the show. It had to go.
maybe next time. I don't know. This is the end of the show. We gotta go. The end of the show.
That's right, we gotta go because Nick D is up next, and there were a bunch of stories that we didn't get a chance to get to. A dad was pranked on his birthday because his sons put his phone number on a billboard.
I love that.
I don't understand. Two Florida men gave their dad a billboard instead of a birthday card for his 62nd birthday. They decided to rent a billboard near Atlantic City for $2,000. It featured his face and the words, "Wish my dad happy birthday, love your sons." So they put his phone number up there so people could call him and wish him a happy birthday. So his phone has been ringing off the hook. And he's received more than how many? 15,000 phone calls. 15,000 phone calls.
And how many of those are from people signing him up for, like, call lists?
Yeah, no, exactly. I don't know. I guess, so. How do you top that next year? Give out a Social Security number? This seems mean. All right, that's that one. There's a push in a community to stop using the term for senior for people who are over 50 years old. I don't know that I call people over 50 senior.
I only do it because I work in a movie theater and there's a senior discount.
Oh, so this is more in relation to discounts.
Well, I think people in general, they don't want to be referred to as people over 50 don't want to be referred to as senior. I mean, obviously, I can't understand why someone would find that. They literally use the word dehumanizing, and I think that's pretty strong. But then again, I'm not over the age of 50. People don't call me senior. I don't know what that, like, realistically feels like. So if someone said to me, "Please don't call me a senior citizen," I just wouldn't. Although there's one sure. Part of that story that really sticks in my craw just a little bit.
Okay. Which part is that?
So the head of the AARP chapter for Arizona,
Alex Juarez.
Yes, he said, "Oh yeah, for like the last couple of years, we've kind of moved away from using the term senior or senior citizen, and using the because we don't want to be defined by our age. So now we use the term 50 plus." And I don't really understand that, because how is that not also defining you by your age even more?
Yeah.
Because it's not just 50 plus yes. What? 50 plus pounds? 50 plus dollars? No, it's 50 plus years. You're literally defining someone by their age. How is that any better than senior?
Yeah, saying you're over 50 isn't kinder than saying senior, is it?
I mean, it's more on the nose. It's more like, yes, you are literally over the age of 50. And I think 50 is kind of a low age for senior. I wouldn't call my mom a senior citizen, and she's like 52.
I mean, my mom calls herself a senior citizen. I just think of her as mommy. I don't.
I call my grandma a senior citizen, and then she hits me with a wooden spoon.
There you go.
That's just how it goes.
Wait, don't do it to your relative. It is only for Denny's in the movie theater.
I'd be curious. Would we then? So if you don't want to be defined by your age, you don't want to be seen as different from the average American citizen. Sure. I get that. I think that's more than a fair request. But does that mean that we can stop giving out senior discounts? Because, well, you don't want to be treated any differently, do you?
Oh, boy.
We can't treat you any
different. Now you're getting into some treacherous waters there,
bingo.
Mr. Millennial.
Yeah.
See, there's millennials. There's a I'm a Gen Xer. There's a baby boomers, the greatest generation.
Silent generation.
Who's the silent generation?
That's the ones between World War One and Two.
Oh, boy. And Griffin's Gen Z, I believe.
Yeah, he's a Gen Z.
Okay, there we go.
Or Gen Z for our friends across the pond.
I don't think I call people senior citizens. If I do, I apologize. And if you're offended, at least I don't know. I don't want people to be hurt. Don't have your feelings hurt. It's a sensory thing, I guess. There are, by the way, one of the things we have to get to before we get to our last story is your review of Captain Marvel. We didn't get a chance to check in with you.
Yeah.
Where is the best place in the city to watch the Captain Marvel movie?
I think there's a little theater on the north side in a town called Rogers Park,
mm-hmm.
little neighborhood. It's called the New 400 Theater. 6740 North Sheridan Road.
Excellent.
Been in operation for over 100 years now. Super historic theater, and we'd love you all to come. We're showing Captain Marvel right now.
Excellent. And what did you think?
I think it is a perfectly serviceable movie.
I don't think anyone wants that to be their review of their movie they've made.
It is what it is. I think the filmmakers and Brie Larson were under an immense amount of pressure from like Disney executives that told them this is what this has to be. The two directors behind it did a bunch of indie movies that are really great, like Half Nelson with Ryan Gosling or Mississippi Grind with Ben Mendelsohn, who is consequently in Captain Marvel because he just plays villains for Disney franchises now. That's kind of his bag. But I think it's completely serviceable. I think there's a lot of fun moments, but it's more connective tissue than anything for the next Avengers that's coming out. And that's my fear with these, is that we've just moved into a territory where you're just watching this one to see what the next one is. And they're not movies anymore. They're just kind of like another thing.
The product.
They're a product. You know, I understand that there is a lot of cultural significance to such a huge franchise having their first female-led movie, and I am very positive about that. That I'm very positive on. But lest we forget that this is made by a billion-dollar corporation that just wants to make money off of you. So please understand that I think Disney's intentions of being progressive or forward thinking are probably mired in cash and the ability to bank on that hype.
So you're saying wait until I can borrow someone's Netflix passcode to watch it.